Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
They're trying to get me to open a package, which I'm supposed is cocaine. You know, I never tried it, so I can't tell you for sure. They're trying to get me to open. You know, at that point, I knew that I wasn't supposed to be there, so I keep on calling the other informant. You know, hey, this is your thing, dude. You brought me to do something, and now, you know, how come you're not doing it? You know, do your thing, you know, let me, I don't even want to be here.
That's Gustav Borjas of South Miami talking with the Sun Sentinel. He brought $23,000 to a drug deal in Sunrise. His lawyer argued entrapment by police, and he struck a plea deal for 18 months probation. This is just one case detailed in a Sun Sentinel newspaper investigation into the Sunrise police strategy of luring drug dealers to their town in order to bust them, confiscating the money, the property, paying overtime, and paying cash to informants. The mayor of Sunrise this week stopped the practice, blaming the newspaper for exposing its tactics. Is it right for cops to troll for drug dealers and use that seized money to pay overtime? Did the newspaper do a public service, or did it do public harm? Let us know on the Florida Roundup today at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Email us at theFloridaRoundup@WLRNnews.org. theFloridaRoundup@WLRNnews.org. You can also tweet us at WLRN or go to the live chat at WLRN.org. Megan Omatz and John Mines were behind the investigation for the Sun Sentinel. They join us here. Join us from the Sun Sentinel here on the Florida Roundup. Chuck Strauss from Miami New Times also along with us on this edition. John, what's wrong with luring drug dealers in order to bust them?
Well, the problem that we saw and that many people commented on was that you're bringing criminals into our town and to our TGI Fridays and Don Panera Bread and that sort of thing. And so why bother to do that? We've got enough crime on our streets. And that was basically the problem with it.
Isn't the argument, though, that you lure them in to get them off the streets?
But they're not getting them off the streets of Sunrise. They're getting them off the streets of New Jersey, Rhode Island, New York, Philadelphia. I mean, it struck us that if the police in Sunrise learned of a drug dealer in Philadelphia, they would be relieved that that guy is in Philadelphia and would want to call the Philadelphia police and say, hey, we have this tip. Good luck with that. But to bring them into the community and risk them doing more danger or harm there seemed to me curious. And what would be the reason or the motivation for that?
John, was there harm done during these busts at public places, as you mentioned, family restaurants like TGI Fridays and other places?
Well, no one was shot, but there was basically a chase. I think it was outside TGI Fridays. Megan, tell us a little bit about that.
People have taken off running, and the cops have had to chase them and send dogs and fire their at least taser guns. After the story published, we had a reader call and say that a retired man was coming out of TGI Fridays with his son after a meal and got a little curious about all these guys standing around on motorcycles. And pretty soon, the bus went down, and he found himself with a gun in his face, telling him, get on the ground. And he went to whistle for his son and said he could have been blown away. Luckily, the officer didn't. He had nothing to do with this sting, but sort of got curious, got nosy about it.
Family night out ending with a real episode of Law and Order right there in the parking lot. John, tell us about how this strategy worked.
The idea was to, by the police, you mean?
Right.
The idea, we don't know exactly what their thoughts are because they haven't really said much of anything to us, except that they're putting bad guys in jail, and that's their job, and they do their job well. That's their argument. But they had confidential informants, one in particular, a very attractive woman, and she would be the person who would lure the people into the drug deal. Now, the people would come, and they'd come with $23,000, sometimes much, much more than that, and their car and maybe a laptop computer and everything. And so they would come, and the drug deal would go through with the confidential informant there and an undercover cop, and the guy might taste the cocaine, swap the money, and then boom, the guys with the rifles, the assault rifles, would move in. And so that was the idea. And then at that point, everything involved in that drug deal could be seized.
The cell phone, the laptop, the tablet, the car, the drugs, and, of course, the cash.
Right. And sometimes it went a little bit farther than that. And Megan can tell you about that, about them visiting houses from outside the city.
So these are Sunrise police officers leaving the jurisdiction in the, as part of these drug investigations.
Right. They might say to the guy, you know, it'll be easier for you if you cooperate with us. You can sign away your rights for let us search your house, whether it's in Miami or Plantation or, I mean, they didn't go to homes in, as far as I know, New Jersey and Rhode Island. But and then they would take $4,000 from your dresser drawer and try to forfeit that. In some cases, they were successful. In other cases, I saw the judges said, no, that $4,000, you know, not no proof. It really was related to a drug transaction.
Megan Omatz and John Maines from the Sun Sentinel. Chuck Strauss along with us from Miami New Times as well. Chuck, what strikes you about this investigation that the Sun Sentinel has uncovered in terms of these Sunrise police luring these drug dealers, perhaps from out of state, into a community in order to arrest them and confiscate the property?
We live in Miami. This is the drug center of the universe, Miami, not Sunrise. And to lure people, it seems to me, to Sunrise, which is far in Northwest Broward, is frightening. And the Sun Sentinel on this, John and Megan, did just fantastic work.
And in fact, to that point, you folks looked at the top cities for forfeiture revenues in 2011 and 2012 in Broward and Palm Beach counties. Fort Lauderdale, large city in both those counties. Lots of people, lots of crime, $1.8 million in forfeiture revenues. Sunrise, almost $6 million, almost three times that amount. Megan, what is it explained solely by this luring strategy?
No, the reverse stings are certainly a part of it. But we really don't know what else they're doing to get that money, and they haven't been talking to us about it. But when we looked at those numbers, we had a good reason to believe it was drug money. And then when you look at the jail bookings, we could see that they were arresting more people on cocaine trafficking than anybody else.
A couple of quick questions here. I mean, one is, what happens, John, to the revenue after forfeiture, or the cash and the property?
It basically goes to a law enforcement trust fund, but that can be used for a lot of things. It can be used for equipment. It can be used for building repairs. It can be used to pay for temps. It can't pay for the actual police salaries.
But it could pay for overtime for those salaries.
Absolutely,
yes,
overtime. And they had an awful lot of overtime in their undercover unit. Their average, they would have tens of thousands of dollars. When we looked at the rest of the police department to see what their overtime average was, it was like $3,600 a year. So basically, it has to go for police-related things. And if it's a state bust rather than a federal bust, some of the money has to go back to the community.
We just got a comment via our Facebook page from Sid saying the Sun Sentinel did indeed a major public service. Sounds like the motivation was money for the police. Megan, is that a fair characterization?
Oh, definitely. The motivation is money for the police officers with overtime and also for these informants. So what struck me as well is if when you think of justice in this country, you have a financial motivation on the part of the police and these informants to set people up and lure them in. So they're creating crime and they have a financial incentive to bring people in to bust them.
Your claim, the police are creating crime.
Yes.
How are they creating crime?
Well, they're doing these fake deals. I mean, there was no crime until they set in motion the, this sting, this trap to work these guys over, no matter where they were from, for weeks, maybe months before they ever got to TGI Fridays. And this is all done with informants, in particular this one lady that they paid $800,000 to. They don't record every phone call with these guys. These informants, the police don't monitor every phone call, so you don't really know entirely what they've promised, except, of course, we uncovered they promised cheap cocaine.
Now, these are very serious allegations, as the two of you certainly recognize, and you're not alleging any illegal activity, but Megan, you're essentially claiming that the Sunrise police are creating crime or opportunities for crime where there is none.
Right. Now, you'd have to say that their position is, would these guys would have found a way anyway to buy cocaine. I, you know, maybe they would have, maybe they're not that bright. Maybe they really don't have the resources to come up with 20 grand. And again, many weren't. They were coming up with 12,000 grand for a kilo that cost 25 and then giving the title to a, you know, a 10-year-old minivan.
Hmm. Now, in the meantime, since this investigation was on the front pages of the Sun Sentinel, you've got the mayor of Sunrise who's responded here, John, and has said that the strategy has ended and has essentially blamed you and Megan and your cohorts at the Sun Sentinel for bringing to light this tactic. Has it done public harm?
They argue that it does. We've heard from both the mayor and a city commissioner spoke at a meeting a week ago, and they say that congratulations, Sun Sentinel, you did a great service to the criminal community. If we don't think so, we think that basically they've argued that you exposed, and they say that they ended the practice while we were doing the investigation, not
prior to publication.
Yeah, but they knew we were out there because this took months to do. And they said we ruined their strategies because we exposed how they do everything, but we couldn't write the story without saying how they do it. So that's why we did it.
But it is important to note you did leave something out of the story upon the request of Sunrise city officials.
Right. The city manager came and spoke to our editor, Howard Saltz, and said, basically, please, very nice, cordial conversation. Please don't identify the confidential informants or our undercover agents. And Mr. Saltz made no promises, but he... We had a lot of talk back and forth about whether we were going to identify any of them.
And you chose not to identify those undercover officers under concern of blowing those covers.
Yes, exactly.
Right. There was one officer that we identified who was sort of the organizer and the head undercover agent, if you will. But he spoke at many court presentations and was identified by name. He was deposed many times. And so basically our feeling was he was the main character in this. And he also, if anybody really wanted to find him, to get him, mm-hmm. all they had to do was walk into the courthouse and pull a couple documents.
It was on public records.
Yes.
One of their main concerns was that they don't work out of the police department. This unit is worked out of a secret office in a commercial shopping strip. And I went there because they created a fake company to do this. And I didn't know. I wanted to see what was this company that seemingly the police set up. And so I knocked on their door and the neighbor said, oh, they're secret police. But
so, the neighbor identified them
yes,
as secret
of course,
police.
Or not so police, secret not police. So secret. I mean, really, and they were very upset that I knocked on the door and came there. But, I mean, if I can find them, I mean, really, you know, anybody else could find them.
Chuck Strauss, go ahead.
When the pedal hits the metal is the conviction rate. So how many of these cases that the cops put together sent drug dealers to jail?
Well, these cases carry a minimum mandatory of 15 years. And of the 114 cases I looked at, two of them, only two, got that amount of time. One, they gave the guy that amount because he didn't turn and wouldn't inform on someone else for their satisfaction. And then another one, they sentenced the lady to 30 years, but she fled. She's not even in jail.
That's not two convictions. That's two who were sentenced to the maximum based upon what they were accused of.
Yes, most of these people enter plea deals because 15 years is just a gigantic sentence. So they get these people to plea, and we saw a lot of drop cases, probation. I think 20 guys or so had 5 to 10 years or so.
Megan Omatz, John Maines with the Sun Sentinel, Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Join us at 800-743-9576. Chuck, this isn't the first case of detailing police off-duty or overtime behavior when it comes to public safety. The Miami New Times has looked at a lot of off-duty behavior on the part of Fort Lauderdale police, for instance.
Well, we looked this week at Fort Lauderdale Police and Fort Lauderdale Beach, you know, one of the highest profile beaches in the state of Florida, where a couple months ago there was a horrible beating on YouTube in front of Blondie's, a club there, in which some guys were just decked and then stepped on and bloodied by bouncers. And one of the things that we found is that unfortunately Fort Lauderdale police, who work off and on duty, weren't necessarily doing the beating there, but they were threatening people with arrest after the bouncers at these clubs beat them up. Those who were beaten up at the clubs were then arrested by cops, and the only thing that showed what really had happened is videos, and there were lots of them on YouTube showing bouncers without provocation just destroying people.
What did you hear back from the police department in terms of their position in regards to off-duty officers being employed as bouncers?
Well, I spent 3 hours on the phone with Fort Lauderdale Police yesterday. Now, they aren't necessarily, again, they're employed as bouncers. They're watching the whole thing. And on some of these videos, you can see officers in uniform watching these beatings. What they claim is, you know, most police forces in South Florida track overtime. So you know somebody worked 30 hours at Blondie's. Fort Lauderdale Police does not track how many hours their guys work. Now, they contend that, well, but I tell my boss that I'm going to work there. It's just I don't tell him necessarily whether I did or how long. So they believe that it's tracked well enough. But if you look at virtually any other police force in the area, you know, there's a problem of conflict of interest. If they're getting paid out of the till at the end of the night, they may be getting paid to turn eye the other way when people are being beaten bloody.
Chuck Strauss with the Miami New Times, Megan O'Matz of the Sun Sentinel, John Maines with the Sun Sentinel. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Still to come on the program, critics take on Common Core. Stick around. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Critics and supporters alike were out this week at public forums with the Florida Board of Education, including in Tampa and Davie.
I don't want my girls to grow up being groomed to work in a certain corporation. I'd like them to grow up with freedom, with an entrepreneurial spirit, that they could maybe go and become business owners and be successful in their own right rather than look forward to working for someone else.
As a parent, this is a heartfelt perspective. I had a struggling reader, and up until 2 years ago, she really was classified, as the struggling reader. But in our district, because we started the implementation of the Common Core expectations, she comes home eager to read. It's the Common Core standards that have changed that perspective and have changed the life of my child. So I just want to know I'm pro Common Core.
Lots of heavy emotion this week with Common Core continuing to be debated throughout the state of Florida, including here in South Florida. Let us know if you've had some experience firsthand or as a parent or guardian or caregiver with Common Core goals in our public schools. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Send us an email at thefloridaroundup@wlrn.org and join the live chat on Twitter at WLRN or online at wlrn.org. Sammy Mack is the education reporter for State Impact WLRN, and Chuck Strauss with the Miami New Times still with us. Sammy, what was the point of these forums?
Well, this goes back a few weeks. And just to be clear, Common Core is this set of new standards that Florida and 45 states have signed on to that set common standards for math and English language arts through all the grades. Florida has already started rolling them out. In general, they're tougher than what most states already had. And the idea is you would be able to compare apples to apples and have
Florida
sort of,
to another state where Common Core is instituted.
Right, right. And so Florida adopted this a number of years ago. But it recently has been getting a lot of attention and attracting a lot more controversy than it did at the beginning. And a few weeks ago, Governor Rick Scott issued an executive order that basically said we're going to slow down a little bit. He wanted to pull Florida out of its financial leadership around this new test that's being worked on and shared with a bunch of different states called the PARC. But basically, it would be the thing that until a few weeks ago, we sort of assumed was going to replace the FCAT because the FCAT is going away.
Mm-hmm.
And within that executive order, he also asked for a series of listening sessions so that parents and teachers and communities could weigh in. So that's what we had this week. It was three of these meetings.
So we listened. Public officials listened. Now what?
Well,
after they've listened, now what will they do?
That is the real question. As my reporting partner, John O'Connor, pointed out on our website this morning, somebody's going to be unhappy one way or the other. We've already started doing this. And if Florida gets rid of the Common Core, which will probably be an election year issue, then there will be 3 years of training at that point and standards that have already been starting to be used that will go away and have to be replaced by something else. But then there are people who really like it and want it to stay on that side. And then on the other side are the parents and teachers and folks who, a lot of Tea Party folks, but not all of them are Tea Party folks, are critics of this thing and feel that it is intrusive and that they wish they had been brought into the conversation a number of years ago.
There's a significant contingent of those critics against Common Core that look at this as a federal government takeover of what has for a long time been state and local policy, which of course is education. What's being driven by education policy usually is local school districts and local school district elected officials and superintendents on the way up to state, where the federal Department of Education has played a minority role. And the concern by these critics is that this is big government telling what local schools what to teach.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting conversation because this is an initiative that was started by a group of governors.
Including former Governor Bush.
Right. And he's a big proponent of it. Governor Crist was a proponent of it. So there has been this sort of conversation where that side, the critics of it, are really equating it with a federal movement. To the extent that the feds have been involved has really been money. They've thrown grant money at supporting this. It has the support money, but they haven't been designing curriculum. That's not something that the feds do. In fact, the Common Core collaborative groups of states haven't been designing curriculum. They've only been setting the standards, and they've been saying to the states, it's up to you to figure out in the classroom how you're going to get the kids to that point so that, you know, at a certain grade, they all have the basic understanding of English or algebra or whatever the standard is. How that happens in the classroom is up to the state or the district.
State Impact Education reporter for WLRN, Sammy Mack. And one of the significant issues that came up during these public hearings was testing and this big difference between the FCAT testing, which so many public school parents are used to here in the Sunshine State and will continue to be for this year, and the lack of a coherent test as of yet when it comes to these Common Core goals. And both you and I know this firsthand. On August 19th here on WLRN, we spoke with Miami-Dade County Superintendent Carvalho and Broward County Superintendent Runcie on the first day of school about this disconnect between the test for FCAT and the Common Core standards in the classroom.
I have at this point no faith that the state of Florida has the systems in place or the willingness to ensure a truly valid, reliable, transparent, honest way of depicting student achievement progress or being able to report adequately what that progress is.
I agree with my colleague, Superintendent Carvalho. I have limited confidence in the state's ability to get there. What I see now is that we live in a very disconnected world where we're moving and advancing in the Common Core arena, but we have an accountability framework in this state that's anchored in FCAT, and that is a legacy system. It cannot appropriately be used to define where our students are in terms of developing and mastering the skills that we know they need to succeed in the 21st century.
So two superintendents from the two largest school districts in the state of Florida both have very little confidence in the ability of state education regulators to test schools. And of course, those tests go to the school grade that so many parents are used to and also go to merit pay. Sammy Mack from State Education Florida and the WLRN education reporter along with us, Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times, and Laura Wides Munoz from the Associated Press. Laura, just from a parental perspective, what strikes you about this? I'm a parent. You're a parent. Tell me what strikes you about this debate.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if this is completely as a parent. I can't take off my journalist hat. But
you can't take off that parent hat either.
Can't take off either. But I will say that, you know, Jeb Bush, who has been, he was a champion of the FCATs, has also moved forward in support, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Sammy, of the new form of testing. And so that's, you right, kind of look, well, if Jeb Bush, who, you know, really started this whole movement, has moved forward, why are we going back? And he's certainly, you know, someone who's been strong in this debate. As a parent, you know, my kid is pretty small and the testing hasn't really started. So I'm sort of bracing myself for when it comes. But I do hope that the standards and the curriculum that we're doing will make them, you know, competitive across the country and not just in Florida. I don't think we're our own country.
And there was a lot of that sort of line of discussion at these hearings from the people who were in favor of the Common Core. A lot of them came up to the podium with reservations about, you know, we support this, but if you're going to do it, you need to have a test that reflects the standards that you're teaching.
I have kids who have been taking these FCATs for 10 years. And you know what? They're not horrible tests. And teachers complain about them. They don't want to teach to the test. But they're basic skills that my kids are learning. My oldest one has taken the PSAT or took the PSAT 2 days ago. I mean, the FCATs orient kids towards that. The core plan, and Jeb Bush was in many ways a dinosaur Republican who damaged the state. But in terms of his education policy, he was a wizard. I think he did really good things. The numbers in Florida and that kids have done have gone a lot better than they did prior to his governorship.
And a lot of this obviously is trying to bend that curve up, not only for Florida, but all those other states that sign on to Common Core. And again, as a parent speaking with my parental uniform on here, I have a child who's close to an FCAT age group ready for that test. And I'm seeing Common Core being coming into the homework that I'm seeing. And it's a lot less of multiple choice. And again, from my perspective, it's a lot more of whys and hows. And I'm speaking to a group of journalists here in the immediate room, and that's what we do for a living. But critics have been unsuccessful in my mind to explain, I think, clearly the hows and the whys focus of Common Core standards and why and how that is such a bad thing to have in the classroom. Sammy, was that articulated at all in these public hearings?
The way that the critics were explaining it, for the most part, and there were a couple of lines of reasoning about why they have concerns about the Common Core. A number of parents were concerned that these standards are potentially not age appropriate, that they're not one size fits all, that you're going to discourage kids who are maybe not the kids who would achieve those benchmarks at the timeline that the state has set out. And that's part of the concern. The other part of the concern I heard some parents say is that as parents, they feel like they're the ones who should be teaching critical thinking and that it's not the schools. I actually heard a parent say that my kid goes to school to learn the ABCs and the 1-2-3s and that's it. So,
and that's why we're falling behind compared to industrialized countries.
I would hope education continues beyond ABCs and 1-2-3s in a formal classroom.
What's really going on here? Rick Scott wants to get reelected. Rick Scott wants to be seen around the state of Florida as a guy who wants to hear everybody because he was a horrible first couple year governor.
Well, I would also add that Rick Scott has, in his first years as governor of the state of Florida, has consistently stepped in front of federal government initiatives. We've seen this obviously, arguably with Common Core, arguably with the Affordable Care Act. We've seen this with the recent lawsuit that the Attorney General of Florida joined with the NRA against a federal law that was passed in 1968 under a Democratic administration in regards to types of gun ownerships for teenagers. So we've consistently, Chuck,
and the billions of dollars for the train that he didn't allow bill.
We've consistently seen the governor step in front of federal government initiatives or claim that those federal government initiatives is indicative of big government telling Florida what to do.
But in this one, he's playing a little bit of a different role. He just wants to hear people. He's learned something in these years as governor, that is, you don't go in necessarily with a hatchet right away. And he looks to be a guy who's just taking into consideration things. And he's not going to do anything before Election Day if he has half a brain.
Chuck Strauss with the Miami New Times, Sammy Mack along with us from WLRN, Laura Wise Munoz from the Associated Press also with us. Join that conversation online at WLRN.org. Send us a tweet at WLRN or call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The government shutdown is over now, and President Obama's number two job, after getting a budget deal with Congress, is immigration reform.
We should finish the job of fixing our broken immigration system. There's already a broad coalition across America that's behind this effort of comprehensive immigration reform, from business leaders to faith leaders to law enforcement. In fact, the Senate has already passed a bill with strong bipartisan support. And economists estimate that if that bill becomes law, our economy would be 5% larger 2 decades from now. That's $1.4 trillion in new economic growth. The majority of Americans think this is the right thing to do. And it's sitting there waiting for the House to pass it. This can and should get done by the end of this year.
The president wanting immigration reform out of Capitol Hill and approved before the end of this year. What's at stake for some was made stark again early Wednesday morning off the shores of Miami Beach. Darren Caprera is the Coast Guard commander.
They had received a 911 distress call from a person on the water who was claiming to be clinging with other people to a boat that had capsized 7 nautical miles southeast of Miami Beach.
4 people died from the small boat. It was carrying 15 migrants from the Bahamas, Haiti, and Jamaica. None had permission to enter the United States. 6 people at the end of this week have been arrested in what is believed to have been a smuggling operation. And Laura, just another tragic indication. Will it push? Does it provide another opportunity for a substantive discussion and movement toward national immigration reform?
I think there are 2 things at play right now. It's unlikely that Congress is going to pass something in the next 30 days, and certainly the Republicans have been talking a lot about how the way in which the shutdown ended and the president's stance has made them, you know, frustrated to such an extent that they're not willing to negotiate or bend on immigration reform. Now, whether they were willing before the shutdown, you know, that's another question. So that may be unlikely, but I think there are 2 things happening here. Today, Obama nominated or sent up Jeh Johnson,
right,
as the new
Secretary of Homeland Security.
Right, and it's very interesting because this is a person who has a lot of background in national security, very tricky, complicated legal issues, which means that the government may be able to put forth the argument that they're being smarter about enforcement, may try to improve enforcement efforts, and thus improve the chances for immigration reform on the other side. At the same time, although the administration denies it up and down, I've never heard anyone say they would do this, there is mounting pressure on the Obama administration to expand the deferred action for youth brought in to the country and who are here illegally to a broader community.
So what are the options that the administration has? Can it go the route of an executive order and bypass the legislative process altogether?
Well, the order that was given for the youth wasn't an executive order per se. It was the Department of Homeland Security. Obama will say, I didn't do it. And they, you know, swear that they can't do that, that it would really be a breach of law. And I think he said that in several interviews. I'm pretty sure there's footage of him saying he wouldn't do DACA, as they call it, for the youth as well.
That's so the deferred action.
Deferred
acronym.
Action. So yeah. Never say never. But that is a hand that could be played. And I think immigrant activists may be increasingly mounting pressure. The other thing that's interesting, you know, Florida is really a hotbed for youth activism on this issue, almost disproportionately to the number of those in the country without legal papers. And what I think we're seeing now is a growth in the next generation of the so-called Dreamers, because you had these youth who were in college during mm-hmm. 2010. They saw the failure of the Dream Act then. And those, I mean, 2010, you know, those guys are now in the working world. A lot of them have gotten the deferred action. Now you have this younger generation that's been doing the, you know, the sit-ins at Broward Transitional Center, and have been sitting in Mario Diaz-Balart's office and in San Francisco and Arizona. They've been stopping buses. So you're almost seeing this new wave of more energized youth, which is kind of interesting.
Well, which is going to have zero effect on reality, because the Republicans, after the shutdown, aren't going to do anything. I mean, Marco Rubio began this kind of bipartisan effort that got it through the Senate. And Marco Rubio is now a great enemy of the administration. There's no way anything's going to happen.
It may
here.
Not happen in the end of the year. I agree with you. But as gerrymandered as our congressional districts are, there are people who are vulnerable. And I think increasingly what you're seeing is attacks on strategic direction at the local and state level.
So we've seen that, right, filter down to state action. We've seen that out west, certainly. We've seen a lot less of it here in Florida as these entry points into the United States, Arizona, for instance, being one of those that's gone a particular route when it comes to immigration. I mean, is there any political will in the state of Florida to take state action, given what Chuck detailed earlier in regards to the governor and education, for instance, but also what you just detailed in terms of Florida really being a hotbed of activism?
I think there's limited amount that the state can do. I mean, obviously, this is the Supreme Court has upheld. This is a federal issue.
Yeah.
You know, Miami-Dade College does give in-state tuition already to those in the country illegally. So, you know, I think it can happen more at a county level, whether sheriffs, law enforcement, who they're picking up, who they're targeting, how much they're directly reporting every single one to Homeland Security. And, you know, again, I mean, you've had people who've been working with Mario Diaz-Balart suddenly sitting in his office saying, we don't want to have another meeting. We want action. And the man, I mean, he's in a tough position, you know, because he's got almost nobody from his party backing him. Same thing in Central Florida. They've been marching and trying to work and I think have swung a couple of votes there. So it may not be enough now, but when you start looking, these are folks who, whether or not they're citizens, they're active, they're politically engaged. When you want on the ground, get out the vote, these guys are ready to go.
And Cuban Americans are in a really interesting position in this because lots of them are Republicans and lots of them, including Mario and Marco Rubio, are facing off against their own party. And it's been a problem for years. That's the one area where Cubans or Cuban Americans have kind of backed away from the Republicanism that has so dominated.
Well, and also I would say the youth, you know, are less Republican dominated. And then you also have the vast, I mean, we have a tremendous Puerto Rican exodus right now that's flooding Florida, Central Florida, South Florida. And while you could say, well, what do Puerto Ricans care? Someone put it to me very succinctly, you know, Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. They aren't directly affected. But, you know, name me one Puerto Rican who doesn't have an Argentinian or a Mexican or someone in their family who is directly affected. So.
Laura Wise Munoz with the Associated Press, Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times. Laura, the president, we just heard, make an economic argument for immigration reform. This week, we teetered on the edge of potentially looking at the default on the U.S. government, arguably, for the first time in 200 plus years. The president saying a priority number one between now and mid-January is to come up with a budget. Of course, the debt ceiling now has been extended to February. His second priority, immigration reform. Does the economic argument carry any water?
I think you could argue it carries a great deal of water. Whether it carries as much water as getting reelected in 2014 in a very conservative local district, you know.
Yeah, and Florida is in play in a big way.
Right.
Florida is in play in a big way here, Chuck. So, you know, we talk about the state politics shaping up in 2014 with the gubernatorial election being really all about likely Governor Scott's social agenda, but perhaps most importantly, his jobs agenda and whether or not how successful he's been on his pledge to create 7,000 jobs in 7 years, which is what he ran on. But on the federal level, this could certainly be a significant issue in some of these districts that are really up for grabs.
Well, and if the federal government could take action, incumbents win. And that's what's got, you know, Mario Diaz-Balart and Marco Rubio moving.
In the meantime, on the economics as well, private industry is recognizing the economic opportunities of immigration. ABC, the television network owned by Disney, and Univision, the traditional Spanish language broadcaster, have teamed up to create a new cable news channel, Laura, that you've been writing about. It's called Fusion, due to launch, I believe, in a week and a half or so. Real quick, what is the kind of the business opportunity that it sees?
Right. Well, I mean, look. Immigration isn't solved, right? It's a huge issue. There's a lot of young folks who would be interested in it. I know they've said that is one area they're hoping to capitalize because it's often ignored in the nightly news. It's not a news channel per se, and I think that's one of the other things that they're trying to do is sort of bust out of the traditional definitions of a lifestyle network or news network, sports network, and kind of throw it all together, mess it up with some sardonic, you know, digital puppet stuff by David Jabberbaum from formerly of
Comedy Central.
Yeah, Comedy Central. Yeah. So, you know, I think they're kind of trying to target, they're clearly trying to target the millennial generation.
I mean, I've been in the news business a long time, and I recall when ABC News struck this deal with Univision, it was about English language Hispanics.
And that's really changed. And I think, you know, people have sort of said, oh, well, you know, they don't know what they're doing because initially they started and they were English language Hispanics. Now it's millennials. I call it Hispanic millennials. They're best friends and beyond, you know, they're BFFs and beyond. I think, you know, nobody knows how to target the future. That's why all these, you know, networks are scrambling because they're losing eyeballs to online social sites and all that. So everything's a little bit experimental. And I think they kind of did the beta testing live, you know, in real time and said, oh, wait, you know, this is a new mix, and this is a generation for which fusion, you know, is no big deal. I mean, you know, my family's cross-cultural. Certainly in South Florida, it's no big deal. Less so in other parts of the nation, but increasingly, you know, millennials are known as sort of this group that kind of, you know, you can be gay, you could be straight, you can, you know, be...
Identities don't matter necessarily.
Which is a great thing for Miami and has been for the last decade. We're the experimenting ground for America. And this has been good in terms of media, from telenovelas to new networks starting here. It's been very good for our economy.
And the one thing, just, you know, money-wise for the advertisers, 18 to 40, you know, nine, that's the target viewing, and millennials are, you know, a good chunk of that. Latino millennials, I think, make up 20% of millennials. So if you just capture that market.
The big challenge, though, and we've seen this with a lot of data, is that age group is not turning on the television. And that's why the business strategy of this is not only being watched within the local community and the local South Florida media, but really looking nationwide and nationally to figure out if these two media giants come together. Is this going to be some kind of chemistry test that's going to be successful for all the stakeholders?
Right, and I think that's why from the beginning, you know, the digital aspect of the presentation was sort of, you know, an essential part of the DNA, not an add-on. And, you know, I mean, they're not the only one doing it. Pivot TV came out sort of for social activism, and Sean Combs has his new channel. But this is the one that is sort of going to have the most news and sort of general affairs subjects. I think, though, that the struggle they face, even with digital, even if they are successful, as we all know, unfortunately, digital ads and revenue just doesn't compare with more traditional sources, TV or print. So even if you get the eyeballs, we have yet to figure out the best way to generate the revenue.
So, Laura, is this going to succeed or is it going to fail?
Time will tell. I mean, you know, people say it has the ingredients to succeed. I think... one cool thing about it, it's got a lot of young people. One problem with it,
it's got a lot of young people. That's right. Well,
and one other aspect of it, you know, it is targeting definitely progressive audience. They've got a lot of top-notched women reporters, editors, and they are trying to be diverse. The top group up there, the creative and executive, is pretty white, pretty male, even if it's Latino white, you know.
Well, it's Fusion. It launches from Miami nationwide on October 28th. Laura Wides Munoz writes about it for the Associated Press. Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times also along with us here on the Florida Roundup. We will welcome Fusion to the Florida media landscape coming up later this month. Still to come here on this program, stick with us. We've got to talk about a poisonous park found and confirmed in the Grove. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. It's on WLRN, and thank you for listening. A poisonous park in Coconut Grove. This week, the Miami-Dade Environmental Office reported higher levels of soil contamination at Blanche Park in the Grove than previously believed. Prior to the release of that report, parents, many of them, speaking with officials with great concern.
Well, my older daughter learned to crawl in that sand, you know, so... a lot of our kids did. A lot of them had it in their hands, in their mouths. We are all hoping, please, that there is absolutely nothing wrong with them, that nothing has happened, but we're terrified.
Jenny Siletovich from the Miami Herald joins us. Chuck Strauss with the Miami New Times also still along with us. I'm Tom Hudson. It is the Florida Roundup. Jenny, what did we learn more today about Blanche Park and the ground beneath it?
Well, the latest round of tests, and there have been many, were more intensive, covered more of the park, went further down, and showed that what they suspected, that there was this contamination with this heavy metals, was indeed there and at higher levels than what they had thought. So then the next step will be, how do they take care of that?
What was found? What is the contamination?
It's a collection of heavy metals, arsenic, barium, lead.
Nasty stuff.
Very
nasty stuff.
You wouldn't want to play in it.
In levels that are dangerous or in levels that are above recommendations?
They're above recommendations. Whether or not they're dangerous is up to the Department of Health to decide.
And so the next step here is to come up with what are called mitigation of cleanup efforts, no?
Right.
Yeah.
I think the very next step would be, what does the Department of Health have to say? They are, whether they're going to recommend that kids be tested right. or not. And then, yes, and then the cleanup. And there's kind of a distinction between what's safe and what's cleanup. You know, they're saying the plastic, the artificial turf that's over it now and the asphalt paving acts as a cap. So it's safe, but that doesn't mean it's clean.
It's still dirty underneath.
Though. Right, right. But it's, yeah. but, so that's the distinction. And that's, you know, what... somebody will decide.
Well, and we heard from the parent earlier, the comment that we played came from early October prior to this most recent report about the significantly higher than anticipated levels of this contamination. What's involved in terms of public health? And where is the health department to answer the concerns of the parents?
They are studying these reports as they come in. And I have talked to a couple different people at the health department who keep saying, we're looking at it. I think because it's so complicated. I mean, I would not want to be the one who has to deal with this, but it's a lot of numbers, a lot of complicated science that they kind of statistically extrapolate out and use models developed by the EPA to determine what are the risks.
Jenny Seletovich from the Miami Herald may not have to deal with it firsthand, but you're writing about it certainly in the newspaper. And Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times, this unfortunately is not the first instance of a popular park that we've heard about with the contamination because of how the land and how the ground had been used generations ago.
Right. I mean, there were dumping grounds across Dade County, particularly Dade County. Fernile Park is one. There are sites literally West Dade. They're all over the county. And one, David Villano, a writer who did a story for us, dug through the records and found that the Department of Environmental Resource Management, the county's environmental authority, had been pushing the city of Miami to clean up parks all over the city, four different places.
Yeah.
And the city of Miami had been dragging its feet. And David went out to a park in, I think it was to Fernile Park, and found... sitting where people are running an old drum of contaminated water that they just left sitting there because they didn't pay any attention to what the county was telling them to do.
Jenny, with this in mind, I mean, again, the land had been used for generations or at least for decades as dumping grounds. I mean, how did Blanche Park, for instance, how did the contamination, this most recent contamination, come to public light if perhaps the county had been pushing for some kind of cleanup for years?
Well, it all sort of started with the old municipal incinerator in Coconut Grove, which if you lived in Coconut Grove, you knew about, but maybe if you didn't, you didn't. So a couple of years ago, the city decided they have a fire training facility there now that they wanted to expand that. As part of that expansion, they needed to test the soil. They tested the soil, found some contamination, notified the county as they were required to do. County said, good, you got 60 days to deal with it. That deadline passed. Another deadline came. In earlier this year, or maybe I think it was earlier this year, the University of Miami has an environmental justice project. One of the students there who was working on another issue right. comes across that old study, you know, starts looking into it, tells neighbors about it. And so the residents start hearing about it. That they get concerned. They start writing letters. The county then steps in and says, okay, now we need to really be proactive. And they order a wider study that includes Blanche Park. Yeah. And Commissioner Mark Sarnoff also asked for the tests on the parks. And that's when they found it.
And that guy, Mark Zach Lipschultz, had even written a story in the Miami Herald a year ago, citing problems.
All right. Poisonous parks in Dade County. Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times along with us. Jenny Seletovich from the Miami Herald also. This is the Florida Roundup, and I'm Tom Hudson. We'll see if the poisonous parks becomes a political issue in the election here that's coming up just in a matter of a few weeks. This is the Florida Roundup. We did have some technical difficulties that we apologize for on the program. The entire program will be online in about 15 minutes, and of course, tomorrow morning on these airwaves at 6 a.m. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow, our executive producer, Peter J. Meritz. The program is produced by Elaine Chin and Alicia Zuckerman. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.